This is the Gig Ready Podcast.
Hey, everybody, this is Jordan Goodfellow here with Gig Ready. Welcome again. Today, we're here with Mark Herring, a good friend of mine. He is the lead technical director and technical producer at 3D Technical Direction, located in beautiful Atlanta, Georgia. We wanted to bring him in today because we're going to be talking about technical direction, producing, and how to create events from the ground up. Mark has been doing this for more than 20 years, and he loves what he does, and he's excited to talk about it today. So, Mark, how are you doing today?
Good. How are you, Jordan?
Oh, I'm doing fantastic, sir. I know that we talked about a list of different questions and things we're going to talk about, but in case it veers off to the left or to the right, just know that that's okay. We're not stuck to a script, and we just want to see where it goes. So I wanted to start out, first and foremost, just getting your definition of a technical director. How do you see what you do, and how does that integrate with a live event in general?
I kind of see a technical director as, someone who's kind of keeping all of the different technical teams together, sort of a colonel, if you would, first boots on the ground, last boots to leave, in charge of all the technical production. So, sound, lights, video, scenery, rigging, labor, to execute what the executive producers and the creative team wants to accomplish in this ballroom or arena or exhibit space, wherever that event needs to take place. The technical director is bringing together all of the artists and technicians, as well as labor and equipment suppliers, to execute that vision, and keeping everybody on task, on budget, and adjusting to the changing landscapes and challenges that might arise on site.
Awesome. So you spend about 3 hours on site a day, right? That's about what it is when you're doing an event.
3 hours would be great. I'd love to be at the pool when we're doing a show in Hawaii or in Cancun, but usually even the most exotic locations, we never really see much more than the hotel room and the ballroom. But sometimes we get out and see some of the sites.
That's very true. So with all that stuff going on, let's talk a little bit about organization. What do you do to stay organized when somebody comes to you and says, hey, Mark, we want to do this event. We're launching this new tech product, and we want you to handle all the technical direction. What are the first things that you do to begin your organization so that you're more prepared as they ask questions and need quotes and all that sort of stuff?
That's a good question, because I'm naturally not organized. So I have to work very hard at staying organized on projects. I know a lot of people are much more organized than me. If you were to see my desk, you would know I'm not very organized. I tend to be right down the middle in terms of creative and organized. So as you can imagine, my desk is cluttered because I tend to love the creative side of things. But when attacking a project for organization, what I'll do is a couple things. I will create a folder in my email system for that specific project, and sometimes subfolders inside of that folder for if there are multiple rooms or if there's another aspect to that production that needs a subfolder. So that'll be the first thing I do. And the way I organize email is, if an email comes in for that project, it'll stay in my main inbox until I've addressed it, and then I will file it into that project folder. I also will create a folder in Dropbox. I use Dropbox extensively as an organization tool. So in my Dropbox, I'll have a general folder for that event inside of a client folder, And then there'll be subfolders inside of there for a tech share folder. We call it a tech share folder that I'll share with all of the department heads. And sometimes those get shared even farther out beyond department heads to actual operators. And in that tech share folder, there will be drawings, there'll be schedules, there'll be other renderings. They might be show rundowns and cue sheets and all kinds of different things that the crew needs to actually execute. And then in folders that I am not sharing with everybody, I'll have budgets, I'll have internal schedules, I might have fire marshal drawings, I might have correspondence with other people that I want to save, and I'll save those in those Dropbox folders so I can access them from any device or that I might be on at the time. Finally, to stay organized, I think I use Wunderlist as a tool to help me with to-do lists and projects, and I organize that by project as well so that I can stay on task and make sure that I'm getting my clients and everybody else that needs things, get those things to them in a timely manner.
So is Wunderlist, I assume that's a software program of some sort. I'm not familiar with it.
It is. It's a to-do software list that you can share with people. So you can actually share those to-do lists with other people inside of your organization. Or I typically just run those Wunderlist for myself to keep me on task and focused on the to-dos for a specific project. And you can set deadlines, you can email those to-dos, you can add notes to that. It's a nice program.
So it's a simplified project management software, essentially, or not? That's giving it too much credit.
Too much credit. It's essentially just a to-do list program where you can check boxes once you've completed the task.
I see. Oh, very nice. So are there other... what about other documents that you use as you're tracking? I assume, of course, schedules, budgets, you know, things of that nature. Are there other specialized documents that you've had to create that took, you know, years of time to figure out? Or are you, you know, is each one kind of a cookie cutter type of document series?
Documents that I use on a regular basis, my on-site schedule, I've kind of cultivated over years, and every time I put one together, I think I can do more to refine it, make it better. My budget document, I'm constantly refining, making that better. I don't have any other organization tools that I'm using from a document standpoint. I do have a pre-site checklist in a Word document that I've, you know, curated over many years of, you know, different things to look for. Much of that I have in my head. I don't even have to pull that document out when I do a pre-site. But if I send someone like you or one of my other technical directors out on site for a pre-site, I'll send that checklist out to them.
Got it. Awesome. Something that Mark just mentioned, talking about me. Mark actually is the one that got me into this completely and utterly, got me hooked on what we're doing from a technical director standpoint many years ago. Mark and I met on a Kia dealers meeting in Las Vegas, I think 2012. I actually was going back through photos of the first job that we did together with Rascal Flatts and, I can't even think of the other band name now. They sing that famous song. And
Earth, Wind, and Fire.
Earth, Wind, and Fire. There it is. Yeah. And just the piles of photos and thinking back to the memories of all the fun that was had in Vegas. I think that was January of 2013, if I remember correctly, maybe 2014.
I believe so, yeah.
Okay. Lots of fun. It's all Mark's fault. So the reason that I'm doing this today is Mark's fault, and I blame him completely and utterly. So with all of those documents, you're managing them, you're organizing them, you're keeping them, you know, structured, you're making schedules. So you get all the way through. What does a pre-production process look like for you? You know, we kind of talked about the documents, but really, if you start at the beginning, you know, you need what? In a perfect world, 4 months to properly do, you know, do a good size, let's say a 500 person general session event that mm-hmm. someone's doing?
Every client, every production company that I work with has a different workflow. You know, ideally we would like to have 3 to 6 months of planning window for a 500 to 1,000 person general session. But sometimes I've done them with only a few weeks of lead time. So it really depends on the work, you know, the client's culture, the end client's culture, and what my production client wants to do and their culture. So it's really trying to be flexible enough to work inside of anybody's model and jump in and be able to do that. But for the most part, we're looking at a 4 to 6 month planning cycle on the larger shows, up to a year or 18 months. And the beginning of that process starts with, on the best shows, the shows that we're the most proud of, and I think the shows that show the most return on investment for the end client, are the shows where the production company engages the technical director in the creative process. Because we can bring a lot of value in that creative process, from deciding what the best equipment is to, or if an idea in the creative process is going off the rails and we can kind of redirect them. But basically, if someone throws out an idea and we, as a technical director, understand what the best technology is to tackle that, we can bring that to bear early in the budgeting process and the creative process and help them curate a creative approach that is unified technically and within the budget parameters. And the best production companies engage us very early in that process and they value our input from a creativity standpoint and from a logistics standpoint.
So, got it. So spend a couple dollars now and then you don't waste hundreds of thousands of dollars later because the CEO wanted to, you know, fly in from the ceiling and they didn't realize that they can't do that in a hotel with 25 feet.
Right, exactly. And then on the flip side, you know, I think you're going to get a better product. The companies that don't want to engage the technical folks early, they don't want to spend that money. They think that they can manage that internally. And some can. Some have technical people on staff and they can manage that internally. But I think the end product, the final product, isn't as well executed because there wasn't that integration early. And that integration and teamwork from the very beginning of the process, I think, plays out from the success of the project, the happiness of the end client, the return on investment for the end client. You know, that small investment on the pre-show, I think, makes a big difference.
100%. Couldn't agree with you more. When you go to a site visit, so they've just contracted you, hey Mark, we want you to do this awesome show, it's going to be great, best ever, you know, it's going to be in Timbuktu nowhere, and we want to go out and do this where we put some projection on a massive rock in the middle of the desert. When you go to a site visit, what things are you looking at? I mean, everything. That's the exact answer that we're looking for. But
right.
When you're in a scenario that might be unconventional, you know, most hotels, loading dock, push to the thing, elevator, where's the ballroom? How do we get in? What are the rules to not break anything? Where's the power, you know, rigging? Are they fixed points, et cetera? But when we go to somewhere unusual where it's, you know, they want to project it, like I said, a rock in the middle of the desert. I think you and I talked about an event similar to that at one point in time or other things. What else are you looking at to justify the capability of doing something in a different location? Or a better example might be the event that you guys just did in Saudi Arabia late last year, projecting on the Old City in Riyadh.
Yeah, I mean, for the most part, when we're doing a site inspection, it is exactly what you just explained. It is just, it's verifying the logistic feasibility that the show that we're intending to do is actually able to be done in that location. If we're going, many times I'm engaged on a site selection process. So we're going out and doing pre-sites at locations that haven't been confirmed yet on a show that hasn't been designed yet. So we know from historical precedent what this client has liked and done in the past. So we're trying to find a venue that would accommodate what they've done in the past, even though we haven't designed the show yet. In that scenario, we're going in and we're kind of looking at historical precedents of the shows that they've done in the past, what they like, what they don't like. And we're trying to verify that the logistics of this venue can support what we've done in the past, even though we haven't designed the show yet.
Got it.
In the case of the Saudi show and some of the other shows where we have an idea of what we want to do, those pre-sites are basically verifying logistics, looking at where we're going to have challenges or what are going to be the more difficult obstacles that we have to overcome at a specific venue. If we're in downtown New York City in Manhattan, you know, a lot of the logistics that we have to overcome are load in and load out at a street level where we have to block the street off, or we need police department there to make sure that parking doesn't get filled up right at the loading door. You know, what times are we going to be able to load in and load out, dealing with union labor, making sure that we're inside of their regulations and rules and not breaking any protocols with the union labor. So those logistics a lot of times are best handled on site. So going to a pre-site and actually having that conversation with the dock manager, finding the logistics person for the hotel that interfaces with the police department, with the union liaison, to make sure that they understand what our logistic challenges are and that they're on board with a plan. A lot of times that's done way more efficiently and quicker going actually out to the venue and hashing that out with those people in person. So, and it doesn't even have to be in New York City. That could be in Marco Island, Florida, sitting with three people from the hotel and making sure they understand that we need to have access to the beach for the beach party. And we're loading in after 10 o'clock and there's a noise ordinance at 10 o'clock. So how can they help us facilitate the load in after 10 p.m. so the police don't shut us down because there's a noise ordinance? So those kinds of challenges are just, you know, a snapshot of the many, many challenges that you might have at a specific venue. And, you know, going for that pre-site will help you navigate those challenges.
Yeah. You often discover many things at the pre-show that's the gotchas. Oh yeah, by the way. And then you show up on site and try and navigate that for during show load in.
Yeah.
Significantly more difficult. So and you get through
I have one client that doesn't like to send us out for pre-sites, and almost every show we get on site and there's a challenge that we've actually requested in our venue letter that we send out before the show. They didn't read the venue letter. We get on site and they're like, oh, you would have known this if you came for pre-site inspection. Well, the client doesn't want to spend the travel money for us to come out on a pre-site inspection. We try to do our best to send all of our specifications in writing to the hotel, but we can't force them to read that document.
Yeah. That's tough. I get it 100%. So you work your way through the process. We do the pre-site, run the budgets, schedules, find the crew. Everybody's done. All the AV vendors are selected, all those sorts of things. Mm-hmm. And then you're flying out. You're headed out to the gig. You're on site now. What are the three things that you need on every single show, bar none? If they're not there, you're not going to be successful.
Well, even before I get on site, I would say one of the things that a technical director really has to rely on is their lead technician. So from a design standpoint, we're tasked with working with a scenic designer, or if we're designing the show ourselves, to design the show. I need to rely on my sound guy, my video guy, my rigger, and my lighting guy to actually fill out and complete the design to the specifications that I've asked them to do and what the client's desires are, and verify that what I've designed and what the scenic designer designed is actually viable. And in the case of rigging, I'm not going to do a weighted rig plot that I send to the hotel. I'm going to have my lead rigger do that and make sure that everything that we're doing is safe, verifiable, and we can send that to the hotel with confidence that we can hang the 200 lights from the ceiling without you know, overloading the rigging points. But so that's the last step before we get on site. And then the three things that I would need on every show, jokingly, I need my Nespresso espresso maker. that's one thing that goes in my.
That's some kit. Serious equipment. Come on now. Don't underestimate the need.
Yeah. But, the things that I pull out of my bag the most are my Disto laser measuring tape. My plans, I'll print out, full size plans to be able to, even though I have it on my computer, it's just something to have that paper. Maybe I'm old school in that, just to pull out a plot and have people around a table to go, okay, here's where this is going to go. And how come this isn't fitting the way we have it on the plan? Let's make this adjustment here. And actually having that paper in front of us with a scale ruler and a tape measure and a laser tape, and we can actually make those adjustments on site to something that didn't in our best intentions, the way we wanted it to go in, isn't going to work that way. So we have to pivot and make a change. To have that piece of paper, you know, on the table that everybody can stand around and we can brainstorm and figure out a way to make that happen is, you know, another thing that I feel like I have to have in my bag. I'll have little bits, tools, you know, audio tools, video tools, little things in my kit that I will bring along, depending on the type of event. If it's a, you know, the big Saudi show, I had different things that I brought with me for life outside in, 80, 90 degree weather. And in Saudi Arabia, if I'm in a ballroom, I'll have some other things that I'll bring with me. So every show I'll have some specific things that are specific to that show, but for the most part, you know, full-size plots, the Disto, some marking tape to mark out the floor, and then an espresso maker.
That sounds like a good list to me. What, now that you've got all your gear, you've got all your stuff, you got all your people, you got the right guys, what are you looking for on site? What are you looking for from the people working for you? What are you watching? What are you looking at? What are the key, the word metrics is a very overly used term, but, you know, staying on schedule, of course, but what are you looking for? What do you see? And are you trying to see, if you were to able to tell someone, this is what I'm looking for, what are those things?
Looking for out of the people I've brought on site, or?
Both. I mean, everything that's there, looking at the global project, the stage hands, the people that are new, the guys that have done, you know, this show four times.
I think, you know, the biggest benefit to me when I'm bringing on a strategic partner from a technician standpoint, an operator, a lead person, is someone who can think on their feet, they're not relying on me for every single answer. They're not waiting for direction on everything. They understand what has to get done. They've read the schedule. They know what the budget parameters are, and they'll execute until they hit a brick wall and they need my assistance, or something's not the way it was on the schedule and they want to figure that out. So, you know, for the most part, I'm looking for people that can play in the sandbox well without a ton of direction other than what I've given them already. And I'm there as kind of the crossing guard, so to speak, just make sure everybody is playing well in the sandbox.
Yeah, makes perfect sense. So you are on site, you're working. Of course, you're a freelancer, so that's what you live and die by, the next gig.
Right.
What are you doing, you know, as you go from event to event to help yourself get better at what you're doing? You know, I mean, because ultimately you learn and you grow, or, you know, some people say you die, but ultimately we know that you just get less gigs because less people want to work with you at that point.
I'm always trying to learn. I'm always trying to absorb new information. And I think I'm bad at documenting that. I'll take notes for myself on specific things on a specific show that I could do better, or something that I want to change for the next time around. But a lot of it is just experience. I'll experience it going not the way I want it to go, and in my mind, I'll just make a mental note that I need to do this slightly different. But that is a tough job, because I get very much invested in that specific project at that specific time, and I don't know if it's just I'm not wired up this way, or the, you know, I just don't want to think about it at the time, but I don't usually take the time to take a step back, take a breath, look at it from a 50,000 foot level and go, here's how I could have done this project better the next time. I'm in the middle of the project. I'm kind of, you know, in the dirt with everybody else making it happen. And if I have the wherewithal to think about it, I'll make a note on my phone, you know, for the next time. But yeah, most of the time I'm just, you know, it's balls to the wall and trying to get the job done right then. And that's really all I'm thinking about.
And then day six comes around and you're like, ah, I just want to go home.
I do actually. I have a lot of appreciation and envy, I guess, for the guys that are thinking about the strike as we're loading it in. And I sometimes will chastise them, like, let's just get it loaded in. But they're actually, their forward thinking is actually saving us money and time on the loadout. They're thinking about the loadout as we're loading it in. I'm thinking about making sure the show goes perfectly as we're loading it in. I'm not thinking about the loadout. And I could get better at that. I know I can. The guys that think about the loadout as they're loading the show in are helping me. And that's, I like having those guys on site. You know, like a good friend, Chris Trosper, a master electrician that we work with a lot. He's constantly thinking about the loadout, even as we're tipping the trucks to come in. I appreciate that about Chris. That's why I want Chris on my job sites, because I know that the lighting's, one, going to go in super quick and efficiently, and it's also going to come out just as quick and efficiently.
Yeah,
that frees me up to think about the bigger picture of the show, not necessarily the loadout.
Agreed. 100%. Those guys like Chris and other people are certainly worth their weight in gold when it comes to getting stuff done. And I found that I learn a lot from them when he'll come to me and say, hey, by the way, did you notice X? And I'm like, oh, that whole batch of cables running across that doorway right there probably isn't going to do us so well on the loadout when we come back. And then we're able to pivot and adjust, and certainly they work very hard to make sure that we look as good as possible. So thanks, guys. We appreciate it.
Absolutely.
As a freelancer, both technical director and just as a freelancer in general, what do you do to find work? People say, you know, because the majority of our industry is freelancers, people that are on their own, they're doing their own thing. They're not staff members. How are you networking, finding work, courting people, saying, hey, I can do this and do it well?
It's actually a very tricky thing. I've never cracked the code on it. I've sent out dozens and dozens of emails to different production companies, and occasionally I'll get a hit from one of those. A lot of how I get work is word of mouth, or producers that move from one production company to the next. The great thing about this industry, and the great thing for as a TD, is that people are in this industry are unbelievably loyal, because if you're good at what you do, people don't want to change. There's a little bit of forgiveness. You know, we say that, you know, the show has to be perfect and you can't screw anything up. And for the most part, that's true. But if you're really good at what you do, there is a little bit of forgiveness from your production company clients, because they know you're a proven resource and they don't want to have a learning curve with a new person. So that's also a challenge. So, you know, with a lot of my production company clients, they want me on site. If I can't be on site, there's only a handful of people that they want to replace me, and trying to cultivate that new talent like yourself and some of the other guys that we use so that my clients are comfortable with me replacing myself with somebody else. If I'm not available and you're not available and you know the few other technical directors that work with me are not available and they go with somebody new, there's a risk that I'm going to lose that client, not from anything that I've done, just because they don't want to have to reteach somebody. So if they're going to invest the time in teaching someone new, I might lose that work altogether. And when I moved to Georgia from Chicago, I saw that with some of my clients. Some of my clients wanted me in the office for those creative meetings. And when I couldn't be in the office for the creative meetings, they hired somebody else, and then I lost that work. Not because they weren't happy with me, just because I wasn't available to come in. So I called around to a bunch of new contacts, and a few of those hit. Some of those have turned into lifelong business partners with me, but some, you know, were just hit or miss, occasional event here or there. It's a very difficult nut to crack. I'm not sure how to you know, get in there, because I think there's a lot of fear and trepidation about bringing in a new resource that you've never tested before. Doesn't matter what their portfolio says. They don't know your company. They don't know how you work, you know, so it's a tough one.
It is. Yes, very much so. Even harder in the gear business, I will say. That's another thing to go over some other day. But what about the jobs you've done? What's the easiest job you've ever done? Easiest one that you can think of? Maybe we don't want to tell anybody it's easy.
I don't know. The easiest job. I used to do some press events for auto show, and the producer at the time liked to do. She was very good at Adobe Acrobat and Photoshop and Illustrator. So I would do an initial drawing, and unbeknownst to me, she would take that PDF into Adobe Illustrator and move stuff around and basically redesign the show. I would do a schedule, and then I'd come on site, and the drawing was different. Still my drawing, but everything had moved around because she had done it in Illustrator. She had ordered all the labor, and I literally would just sit backstage and work on the next show. Finally, I told her, like, you got to stop spending. I said, I don't want you to spend your money on me just because you want me on site. You're doing everything anyway, so you might as well just hire someone cheaper than me as your, you know, fireman insurance policy, because I don't want you to waste your money. So she agreed, and she. So that was probably the easiest show, because I had very little to do front end, and then she would take over, and then on site I was just standing around.
Not bad. I like it when other people do my job for me. It can be fun.
I felt guilty about it though, so I told her to find somebody else.
Well, but then it's also annoying, honestly, when you get on site and then people are asking you questions about, well, there's a seating section over here. And then you're like, well, what are you talking about? And then the chair guy pulls out a drawing that has a seating section that a seating layout I've never seen before.
Exactly right.
When it was my job to be responsible for the seating layout. So
what about the opposite side?
The toughest or the most challenging, whether mentally, you know, I mean, we do these elaborate setups, huge arena shows, whatever, but like just overall, like you walked away from it saying, I don't know if I ever want to do that one again.
I actually have a lot of those. I think people hire me because I'm good at doing those impossible shows. So I've had a few of those. The launch meeting for Abbott Humira was in San Francisco, and that was a huge, huge show. We had a flying by Foy rig over the audience, rig seating, and we literally had 36 hours to load it in with a full Local 16 union crew. So we had to work essentially 36 hours straight without stopping. And to get it all in on time, and nothing could go wrong. And of course, certain things did go wrong. But we were able to make it happen. But it was, that was a stressful one.
I'm assuming you didn't sleep for 54 hours or whatever it was to make that one happen.
I would take naps. We actually, one of the things I did for this job specifically was actually create in some adjoining breakout rooms, set up some cots. So some of the lead crew that couldn't leave could go take, 30-minute power naps. And then in another adjoining room, we had a massage therapist with chair massages. So only the lead crew could go in there, do a 15-minute chair massage. That was pretty nice. So that was a tough one. And some of the challenges were, dealing at one point I had 115 local 16 hands on site. And, one of the guys in the audience riser crew was like a cancer on the whole show, just complaining and complaining, complaining. So I had to release him, and it became a big issue with the union because he had the most seniority in the room. So nobody wanted to fire him because he was the most senior. And wow. It ended up like the president of the union came down to try to convince me not to fire him. And it was, so that was an issue. And
Was it an attitude thing? Was it
he was the most senior, also the oldest on the crew, and he was put on the audience riser crew. So it was very, very strenuous, hard labor, setting up these audience risers are not easy. They're heavy and it's a lot of work. So he wasn't in the right department, and he was just being a real complainer about it. And he was bringing down the whole crew. So it was tough.
That is never fun.
The Azusa Now show we did at the LA Memorial Coliseum was a very challenging show. Building a humongous stage with cranes and stuff that, we had a crane that broke and got stuck in the, building a huge front of house. And then, of course, it rained on everything, which we had some rain protection, but not enough rain protection because we weren't expecting it to rain in Los Angeles. So
in Southern California in April.
Right. Yeah. So that was a challenging one.
We couldn't walk on the grass.
Right. Right. The Saudi show that we did in November was a huge challenge. I mean, set records. We had projection mapping across 1,000-foot vista with 220,000 lumen projectors, 76 projection areas, tons of D3 servers that were driving that whole thing, and on a UNESCO World Heritage site that we weren't really allowed to touch. We had to work around with where we were running cable and how we attached stuff, to the walls and to the floor. They were very particular about what we could do, because it's a World Heritage site. And it's essentially a mud city. So we had to be very, very careful with that. And then, all the structures that were being built around that and some of the logistic challenges that we were dealing with there. It also rained there, ironically, in the desert. So that was an interesting challenge as well.
Did it rain a lot?
It rained a lot the night before the show.
Of course it did.
We had to... And then because we were dealing with royalty, the royal family was going to be there. The Royal Guard was going to lock down the site at some point. So we had to bring all of our spares, which we had in a boneyard on the other side of the highway. We had to basically bring a bunch of trucks to go bring all the spares that we had available and bring them onto the site and store them in our production village, just because we knew we were going to have a bunch of failures from the rain. But the next day, the Royal Guard was going to lock down the site and we wouldn't have access to the spares. So we brought all the spares over overnight and had them available so that when the crew showed up in the morning, even though the site was locked down by the Royal Guard, all our spares were on site and we could be changing out lights and things as during the day.
Did you have as many failures as expected, or was it a pleasant surprise?
More, We had only one failure that actually, I think, affected what the creative director wanted for the show. It was a projector that was in the grandstand that was projecting onto a roadway across a bridge that went across. We lost those two projectors due to rain. The rain cover wasn't strong enough for that, and it broke. And we couldn't get a lift in to replace those two projectors. So those projectors never got replaced. I think that was the only thing that would have been noticeable by anybody who knew anything. I don't think anybody else understood that. What, they didn't miss anything. But if you had seen the rehearsals, you would know that we didn't have that one little section of bridge projection for the show.
Got it. So what do you like most about being a technical director? You've stayed a technical director for a long time now. You know, of course, you and I have discussed a lot about the idea of a technical producer being more than just technical director, but also helping with the design and making it look, you know, adjusting things, making it look prettier, making it more, you know, cohesive to the audience, making them feel better about what's going on. What do you like the most about doing what you do?
I think that even though the processes that we go through are the same, every show is a different puzzle. It's a different challenge. It's a different riddle to solve. Even if I'm in the same venue, the same client, same schedule, you know, same thing year over year, every year there's something that's different. So we're doing, the setup is a little different. We might be doing the same setup, but the technology is a little different. The crew's a little different. Everything, there might, even the slightest change is a different puzzle. It's a different challenge. And that suits me personally. I would not be the kind of guy who could go into an office every day and do real estate closings or, you know, do accounting. I just would go crazy. I need a new challenge, a new puzzle to solve, a new riddle to solve every day. So yeah, that's my favorite thing about being a TD, is that every project is a new challenge, something new to overcome, something new to learn. So,
and how about the thing that you could leave behind? You're like, well, if I could get rid of this part of being a technical director, I'd love to like delegate this to somebody else. What's your least favorite?
Probably budgeting. I hate budgeting. I hate putting budgets together. I would just love for someone to say, just make it the best ever, and I don't care how much it costs.
Putting
budgets together is my least favorite thing. I don't love doing schedules, but I don't know if I could. I don't know how I would delegate that other than training someone who understood how long it took to do something to do that schedule for me. And you know, a lot of that is learned. And once you've learned how to do that schedule for me, then I'm going to put you out as a TD on one of my other projects. I'm not going to have you sit behind a computer and do a schedule for me. I'm going to have you be doing, you know, earning money for yourself and for the company, doing actual projects, not doing schedules for me. So
makes sense. Awesome. What, shifting a little bit, what vendor selection? One of the toughest things I think that we deal with regularly, because there's so many influencing factors that come into it. There's producers, executive producers, relationships. Sure. I mean, what are you doing? How are you handling vendor selection as a technical director and managing that process of who's supposed to do this gig and who shouldn't do this gig?
Yeah. It's a very gig specific, obviously. You know, if you have a small budget challenged project, I'm going to choose a turnkey supplier that's usually regionally based. So if I have a show in Phoenix and it's a small, lower budget show, I'm going to go with a company that can do everything in Phoenix, because I don't have trucking, I don't have travel. And so that'll be, you know, a lot of that is determined by project size and budget. And then some of it, the clients, my production clients will tell me who they want to use. Even if I can deliver the same quality for cheaper with a regional client, they may say, no, we want to go with XYZ company out of Chicago because that's who does all our work. And so a lot of times my hands are tied on that, which I'm fine working with any vendor. You know, my clients sometimes will ask me, who would you like to use in this scenario? If it's a big show, a very, very complicated show, I wouldn't choose a turnkey supplier. I'm going to parse it out to individual specialists, you know, an OSA just to do audio, or a Firehouse Production just to do audio, and, you know, a Zenith lighting or upstaging just to do lighting. I'm going to make sure that we've got, you know, the best partner for the right department in that scenario. And a lot, my clients in those larger shows, they may have their preference on a vendor, but a lot of times they'll ask me to put that out to bid. So I'll send out an RFP to two or three vendors that I know have the credibility and the portfolio to do a project of that size. And when those bids come in, I'll work with my client and we'll make a decision on who the best vendor is. And a lot of times that's not specifically based on price. We may not go with the cheapest vendor. We may go with the mid-price vendor because we are more comfortable with that.
Very nice. Makes sense. The people out there, those in the Netherverse that want to be the next level, you know, they're right now, they're working, they do breakouts, they do, you know, assistant management, project management, that sort of stuff. And they want to go up, you know, mm-hmm. they want to move on to the next level. What are things that they can be doing now to say, hey, I want to be being a technical director. I want to be a technical manager, a project manager, whatever. Yeah. What are a couple things they can do to help, you know, gain more skill, do more, get better at what they're doing to increase their game?
I think probably the, you know, two things would be, I think the best things that you could do. One is to increase your knowledge of every department. As a technical director, you have to kind of be an expert in every department, a jack of all trades, master of none, you know? So if I, in that aspect, capitalize on every training opportunity you can do. Go to the Yamaha audio training seminars and expos. Go to one industry trade show every year, whether that's Infocom or NAB or LDI. You know, choose to spend the money and go and invest in your knowledge and expertise on everything. Walk the exhibit floor, learn about the new products, go to the trainings and the breakout sessions to learn how to program the new whiz-bang grandma console. And, you know, the more knowledge you can have, the more tools in your toolbox from that side of things is going to help you as a TD. You may not program on a grandma, but what happens if your lighting programmer comes down with coronavirus and you have to jump in and help? If you understand a little bit about the console, even though he's pre-programmed some of it, you can jump in and actually navigate the console because you know the constructs because you took a training class. You don't have to be the expert on the grandma, but you understand the ins and outs of it and you can actually jump in and save the day. I've seen a TD, not on my show, have to jump in behind the soundboard because the audio guy had to leave. That's a very viable situation. I've had to run camera. I can jump in and video direct if necessary, or, you know, I could run sound if I needed to because I have that expertise behind me. So if you're coming up, capitalizing on every possible opportunity, investing in your future by going to these conferences and expos and going to all the breakouts that you can to learn about every piece of equipment, every possible thing that you can do would be one. Big one. The next one, as a TD, the best thing that you can do is to really get good at drafting. Pick a platform, whether that's Vectorworks or AutoCAD, and just keep working at that muscle. And you can, you know, learning all the new tools, learning how to navigate in and out, to draft quicker, to be more efficient, to draft in 3D, to be able to do renderings you know, making the pretty pictures out of the drafting. As a TD, those two skills would serve you the most.
Love that. That's outstanding. Now, as we're kind of wrapping up here, one of the main goals of this show, podcast, whatever you want to call it, all is ultimately to help everybody become better, more gig ready for the next gig. So what are two things they're listening to this today and they have a gig tomorrow? Two things that they can be thinking about that can say, okay, these two things are going to help me gig better tomorrow, not 5 years from now, not when I reach the epitome of my career, but you know, tomorrow. What are these, what are something they can be thinking about?
You know, I occasionally will have this reoccurring nightmare before a really large show that I forgot to order the local labor, or I, on my schedules, I transposed one number and I'm a week off and I'm going to show up on site and no one's going to be there because everybody's the next week. So, and those recurring nightmares always force me to do one thing the day or two before I go on site, is to kind of go through my head, in my mind, walk through the load-in and make sure that I've, you know, as I'm going through the schedule in my mind, that I've put all those pieces in place, that the forklifts have been ordered and the riggers are on the right schedule. Going, you know, many times as an anecdotal example, I have to put in a rigging advance with PSAV to order all the riggers. I'll do that months in advance because they want that information way before we've really drilled down on everything. And yeah, many times they haven't looked at my hotel letter or the schedules that I've sent since then. They're still going off the rigging advance, which has the wrong load in time. So going through that process a day or two before sometimes brings up those red flags that I've actually ordered the riggers at 6 a.m. on the load in day instead of 8 a.m. when the schedule changed. So I've caught that stuff ahead of, you know, and sometimes I haven't caught it, but many times I'll catch that prior to getting on site. So walking through, you know, not minute by minute, but just walking through those, you know, key points in the schedule in your mind, making sure that you've ordered the forklifts, that you've given the right schedule time to the local labor, to the union riggers, or, you know, to the ballroom guys that are dropping chairs, and you make sure that they know to come in at 7 o'clock on the day of the load in instead of 8 a.m. the next morning, because that's when the rehearsals are starting now. Those kinds of things are, that's a big one. Just walking through in your mind and making sure all the I's are dotted and T's are crossed. The second thing would be, I think one mistake that I make, because I'll be running around working on multiple projects at the same time, or, you know, spending time with family, is packing my gig bag, you know, my mobile office the day before I have to leave. So if I have to leave on a Friday for a Saturday load in, packing my gig bag on Thursday when I'm not stressed about, you know, getting ready to go, packing my luggage, actually packing my gig bag, making all my printouts, and that's when I'm walking through the show in my mind too. As I'm printing out the schedule, I'm looking through the schedule and walking through it in my mind, packing my gig bag up the day prior to me leaving, so that I'm not stressed out with, you know, all the logistics of getting to the airport. Yeah, would be the second thing I would encourage people to be gig ready.
That's awesome. I should do that more often. I'm the guy throwing stuff in my bag 2.5 hours before my flight's supposed to take off, and I live 45 minutes from the airport. So
yeah. I've done that too. There are many times I'm like 10 minutes from the house and I turn around because I forgot something and I need it.
Yeah. You know? Yep.
So, and then the other thing that helps, especially on the printouts, like what happens if you run out of paper, or you run out of toner, at least now you have some margin, you have some runway to get that stuff remedied before you have to leave.
Yeah. Building margin into life is something I've been thinking a lot about lately. And I think that especially goes in our industry, any margin that we can give ourselves, whether that's load in, whether that's before the event, whether that's before we leave, it helps to make sure that we can accomplish the task at hand. Because without that margin, event, something's got to give. And, you know, sometimes it's the important thing that ends up having to not be as good as it could be because we lack that margin.
Yep.
So awesome. Well, hey man, thanks so much for taking the time today. I appreciate it. I hope you're well. I'm hoping your family's home and healthy and safe and all of this excitement of the corona.
Excellent.
Well, fantastic. Well, hey, have a good evening. Thanks for everything. I appreciate it. And I'm sure we'll talk soon, but take care and have a good night.
Yeah, you too.
Awesome. Thank you so much for joining us today. I am so excited and so humbled that you would choose to take just a little bit of your time to join us on this podcast and listen in on some of the great conversations that we're having. I hope that your next gig is better than your last, because ultimately that is all that matters to me. I want to make sure that you are able to do better events, better shows, better tours than you did yesterday, all because you gained valuable information and valuable knowledge from what we discussed here today. You know, I think that every single day we are looking to get better, and that is exactly where I want us to be. Now, the value that we bring to you is directly tied to each and every one of you. We could sit here and talk all day long about all the stuff we do, all the great events and everything like that, but if we're not giving you the value that you want, there's no way that this is going to be good for you. And ultimately, who cares who I talk to if you're not getting value? So please let me know. GigReady@GigRent.com. You can reach out to me. I'll make sure to read every single email, because I know that it's valuable to you to be heard. And I want you to share your ideas, your thoughts. Who do you want to have on the podcast? Who do you want to share? What are things you want to learn? What are things you want to grow in so that we can get better at creating live events? People connect in person, and each and every one of us facilitates that process in our own small way. I'm excited for what the future holds. I'm excited for where we're going. I know that there are great things ahead of us, and they're not just behind us. Have a great rest of your day, and we'll see you next time.